Hello there, folks, and welcome to a very special Halloween mini-episode of the Press Play and Scream Horror Podcast. I am Josh Brant.
I'm Kelly Hager.
Thank you again for joining us. We have decided that since we have beaten the dead horse, which is at this point John Carpenter's Halloween franchise, that for this Halloween, we would shift focus onto a different Halloween-themed horror film. In this case, Night of the Demons. Kel, what'd you think of this one?
I really liked it. I'm sad that I didn't see it earlier because I feel like it would have been one of my favorite horror movies as a teenager. It definitely has like sleepover party vibes.
I can definitely see that. Yes, absolutely. And of course, the stars, Linnea Quigley. I mean, you could do several hours on her resume alone in terms of horror. She is an absolute sex symbol in the horror industry. Probably my favorite horror icon, or certainly one of them. Just incredibly funny woman. She's got great comedic timing. Her face is hilariously expressive. She's got a weird amount of acting range given, the kinds of films that she starred in. But between this movie and Return of the Living Dead and even Sorority Babes, the Slimeball Bowl-a-Rama, you've got three different kinds of characters that she's bouncing back and forth with there.
Absolutely. And what I also love, and what I actually know her from originally, which is unfortunate because her part is very, very small, but she is one of the people in Freddy's chest in Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master.
I had no idea. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting bit of trivia there.
Oh, and, yeah. Watch it now. You'll know which one for sure.
Is it one that has bare breasts? Because given that it's Linnea Quigley, you would think that probably that'd be the case.
And Circle Gets the Square, yes.
Yeah, you can't really talk about her career as a horror icon without the fact that, I mean, she has a fantastic willingness, and always has, to show her naked breasts and vagina for titillation and or shock value. She's completely fearless about it and very exaggerated and unself-conscious about it. And I feel like that's one of the things that makes her stand out, is her ability to use her body for sex, for horror, for comedy. And especially in Return of the Living Dead, that's going to be one of my favorite horror scenes of all time, when she just like the trash is taken off her clothes again, moment of it.
I don't think I've ever seen that movie.
Oh, wow. You definitely need to. It's in your library. I mean, again, you know how I feel about zombie films. I think they're usually a huge snooze, but this one is just fantastic. It's one of the best ones ever made.
Yes. Well, as you know, recently we talked about popular things that I do not love, like magic and costumes. But one of the things I very much love is buying movies and then not watching them.
Yes, that is a trend. I could see that. As you started that sentence in my mind, I'm like, well, she doesn't dress as a clown. She doesn't do any magic. The one cool thing about this movie, though, is that Quigley is again paired with Hal Havens, who she co-starred in Sorority Babes with, and he plays this same kind of beefy, crude, gross male stereotype, right down to the pig nose that he wears, which is hilarious and makes him look like Bebop from the Ninja Turtles cartoons. But
it does. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, and so he does a fun job in this movie for sure. And he went on Havens to be one of those guys who's like done one episode of basically every TV series ever. Like, he's still working, which is kind of gratifying to see. But so it was kind of fun to see those two teamed up again. What did you think of the rest of the film?
I thought it was very fun. I love how basically, for the most part, until the end, the demons weren't really scary. Like, they didn't look different until, of course, the end, when they very much did. But it kind of made everybody a more heightened version of themselves. Like, for example, Stooge lost the ability to speak pretty much and was basically just wandering around like grunting and trying to catch people. But Linnea Quigley, her character, that really, with the lipstick and the whole, is my face okay? And her whole face at this point is covered in makeup, lipstick specifically. And then, you know, she's having sex with the guy who was Kurt in Heathers, who is Jay in this one. Lance Fenton is the actor's name. She's having sex with Jay, and then she's basically screaming, like, don't look at me, stop looking at me, and then gouges his eyes out, which was just... I probably had the most visceral reaction to that scene because, like, ugh. Although, yeah. Later, when they were like, I forget the exact line, but it's something like, don't you like your blind date? Which was my absolute favorite one-liner from the film.
And there were a lot to choose from. This was a fantastically, darkly funny movie. And the don't look at me scene, first of all, of course, it was fun to see Lance Fenton in this, knowing that he would go on to do Heathers.
Yes.
And not much else. And he's always a hoot because he's the high school student who, you know, looks like he's 35 and selling real estate. But
he does, though.
He does, right? But that was a legitimately scary scene. And I like that the ways that the people turn into demons in this movie in some ways mirror The Exorcist and also are a huge nod to the Evil Dead movies, where the corruption of the soul becomes instantly visible in the flesh at certain times. And the makeup of this movie is astonishing. And I remember mentioning to you while I was watching it that there is the scene, like you mentioned with the lipstick, where Linnea Quigley's topless. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, she's gorgeous, but if she's had work done, it wasn't awesome. And then she shoves the lipstick into her breast and it got me because I was like, wow, that was a fake torso. And
yeah,
you know, I went to film school, and like Coop and I were saying during the Halloween Kills episode, you know, our eyes tend to look for those seams and the special effects even more than most people. But, you know, this is a cheap, relatively schlocky 80s flick, and it fooled me legitimately. And that is impressive. And it lent a very bloody, fleshy kind of realism to the gore effects in this film.
Yeah, I really would love to watch the documentary about it. I have not seen it yet. I haven't even seen it anywhere to stream, but I would love to know more how they did just about everything.
Yeah, the mechanics of this movie would be interesting to know more about. Now, I remember that you mentioned in particular the shoplifting scene is definitely one of the standout scenes in this.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's just, it's so fun. It feels almost like the screenwriter must have thought, okay, how can we make this the most fun horror movie possible, but still also make it genuinely creepy in parts? And it was very effective. I love this movie. And I think this is probably going to become part of my Halloween rotation now.
Yeah, mine as well. The scene was terrific. I love that scene because I love exploitation cinema in general, and I always have. And this is the perfect example of that, how, you know, that kind of film is about giving us what we're not supposed to want, and not just giving it to us, but I mean, dumping it over us by the bucketful. And then it punishes our on-screen avatars for wanting that thing so that we get to feel better about ourselves as an audience. So you've got these dumb, horny males who are watching the film who would totally be staring along with the guys at the counter. But then, you know, we get to laugh at the guys at the counter and feel superior to them. But, you know, let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I love how her friend, Angela, doesn't even really wait to get out of the store to tell her friend to stop. Like, her friend stops. And so the guys could, in theory, note that she is walking out with what seems to be half of the convenience store items in this giant sack that she is holding like she's carrying a baby. But it's this huge sack full of stuff. But nope.
No, I mean, their brazenness is part of it. I mean, because every youth in this film has that level of brazenness and that level of kind of seeming indestructibility and immortality, you know, the teens have, which makes it, of course, all the more hilarious to watch them all go tumbling down by the end of the film.
And I feel like, too, This is one of a very few movies I can think of where almost every single character is annoying in one way or another. Roger is great, but pretty much everybody else is at least garden variety awful.
Oh yeah, totally. This is one of those films where you absolutely cannot wait to see these kids just eat it by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And speaking of eating it, we have touched on previously the recurring Halloween theme of people putting razor blades into candy and apples, which of course is hugely featured in this and is extremely unsettling. And the thing is, though, that if you search that, you'll find there are a handful of recent examples. But during the period where this film came out, that whole thing was basically kind of considered to be an urban legend. And it was like something that, like most urban legends, are it's so lurid that people almost wanted to believe that it was true. And now if you Google it, you know, again, it's kind of come true, but I'm wondering, is that life imitating art? Did our secret desire for it to be true end up making the urban legend kind of, you know, plant the notion in somebody's head? And also to a certain degree, I wonder how much those Halloween legends kind of might have stemmed from the Chicago Tylenol murders of 1982. The idea where someone was out there lacing acetaminophen with cyanide, and the idea of like murder can be a very personal thing, but some stranger who's just out there painting seemingly innocent things to kill people he's never met before is senseless, and that sort of captured the public's imagination possible.
It's funny you say that, because I was just talking about that recently, and when I say recently, I mean at some point over the last 2 years. One of my favorite podcasts, My Favorite Murder, did an episode on it, and they never solved that. Like, they never know for they never knew for sure who was actually doing it. And I think the theory is that it might have been two different people based on like the people that died, because the one, I want to say that there is a chance that the second batch that killed people, it might have been a copycat designed to specifically kill those people. But it's weird because you get one rash of medicine poisoning, and now all of a sudden you need basically an engineering degree and incredible arm strength to break into medicine. But, you know, you want to shoot up 300 schools full of children and have at it. We won't change a thing.
Yes, that is a very interesting point for sure. So even something like this can kind of reflect those larger cultural themes, even though, again, this is very much a splattery, schlocky kind of, you know, kill all the teens and show all the tits kind of film.
Yeah.
And, you know, speaking of that, I mean, how do we feel to a certain degree about this level of TNA in horror movies? We were talking about that a little bit, and the fact that, you know, there's an argument, again, in exploitation's sake to be made. But then again, you've got something like Scream that was able to deliver solid scares and cultural references without that sort of thing.
I don't necessarily mind. I feel like you have to expect a certain amount of sex and nudity for horror movies and slashers in particular. Honestly, the only part that I didn't like the eye gouging. Body-related horror with eyes and teeth, like, I just can't. Like, that's a very big no for me. But besides that, like, the one I had a real problem with was at the very end, where the cranky old man's wife makes him an apple pie with his tainted apples. And honestly, that had to be on purpose, right? Like, we know that she was deliberately setting out to become a widow.
Oh, based on the punchline of the movie, that's absolutely true, yes.
Yeah, she's the real hero, because as awful as most of the people in this movie are, like, he was maliciously awful. I do hope that he gave Judy's little brother an apple, though, because I didn't like that kid either.
Ah, that kid sucked, but, you know, most kids do. One thing that I also noticed was in this film, because you've got a film from the late 80s here, and the demonic possession is if not quite sexually transmitted, close to it, by being spread via kiss in many of these circumstances. You know, like, this kind of goes back to the TNA idea that violence and lust are both, you know, the impulses that we're supposed to repress according to society, and wanting what we're not supposed to and being infected by evil as a result. You've got a girl-girl kiss, which evokes homosexuality, but it's still titillating to a straight male audience, so that's okay. And so I'm thinking that, like, this might not have been a wholly intentional AIDS metaphor, but given the era of its release, it's a little weird to shake that idea.
That is a solid point, too. And it also, I think that's definitely highly possible. I do think it's interesting that, according to IMDb, we were supposed to get also an interracial kiss, but that got cut. I'm guessing Judy and Roger, after Roger basically saved her throughout the course of the movie, really. But it's interesting that, like, the demons kiss, like, Suzanne kissing Angela to get Angela also possessed, like, that's totally fine. But the idea of Judy, who is white, kissing Roger, who is black, like, that apparently is, like, a bridge too far.
Yeah, that's pretty disappointing, all right. The idea that, that's all fine right up until that point.
Yeah.
And that's American cinema all over, unfortunately, and that's such a shame. Because you've got, I mean, blood by the bucket load, gore by the suitcase full, and that's all okay. I mean, wait, you've got who kissing a what? No, we can't have that. Certainly.
Yeah, no, hard pass.
And another kind of anachronism that I've noticed in this film was the Sal character, who's played by Billy Gallo, and he's doing this kind of a Mickey Rourke impression from the beginning of the film to the end, and he's the archetype that was just so very popular in horror at that time, because it was what the adults who were writing horror thought the quote-unquote bad kids of their youth still looked like, these quasi-Latin or Italian, like, greaser thug stereotypes, like, out of The Outsiders with the antisocial attitudes. They've got, like, leather jackets and switchblades in the 80s we're talking about. And to these people, Fonzie still basically represents the counterculture to them.
It does. And also, he's the only one that has any sort of accent. So I don't know if we're supposed to think that he moved there from away. But yeah, like, that whole thing was weird. And I also really liked how it turned out that, except for Roger, he was the only decent guy in the movie. Like, I would not have seen that coming. But he ended up being better than everybody.
Yeah, and that was a fun little reversal. And in terms of the accent, I mean, what can I say? Like, that kind of insouciant Brooklyn, New York accent can pop up in the most unlikely of places. Ask James Franco or ask me. So I'm not one to talk. But yeah, that was an odd little representation of the counterculture there.
Yeah. But such a fun, fun movie. And I feel like the credit sequence, specifically the opening credit sequence, just does a really great job of showing, like, okay, we're a little spooky, but also we don't take ourselves too seriously. You know.
That was a very fun opening sequence.
Yeah.
A terrific, simple yet effective bit of animation. Sort of almost on the par with like a gory cartoon. In terms of, like, fun but macabre, and I really
like that. I want to see the sequel. I know there's a third one as well, but I haven't been able to find that. The remake looks fun, and the remake, I think, is from 2000 maybe, and it might be even more recent than that, but one of the people in it is Edward Furlong.
Really?
So hopefully they're not supposed to be high school kids, because that's like Andrea Zuckerman and Beverly Hills 90210 levels of really bad casting for teenagers. But they say that if you like the original, you're probably going to like the remake, because they have the same sort of vibe.
In 2009, it's hard for me to believe that somebody would have been able to match the vibe of a film like this, because culturally, the landscape has changed so much that, I mean, shoving this kind of thing in audiences' faces, I love it. I think that it's timeless. Most people do not.
Yeah. And I feel like you would not be able to do a lot of the same things, but I think you could match the vibe, but you would have to make the movie almost entirely different, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I'll check it out, obviously, having seen this one, but you know, my expectations would have to stay pretty low there.
I agree. That might actually be streaming on Shudder. And I would also like to point out that apparently Amelia Kincaid, who plays Angela, also is in Night of the Demons 2 and Night of the Demons 3.
Well, she was such a standout in this film.
Yeah.
This was easily on par with someone like Feruza Balk in The Craft. I mean, she, in her own way, in this film, established herself as this fantastic cultural goth staple, albeit a less well-sung one than, you know, Balk in The Craft or Morticia Adams or that sort of thing. But I mean, Elvira, but a very similar presence on screen. And that's a hard thing to pull off.
I would agree. And she's actually, she is the prototype for Feruza Balk. Yeah. Oh, and a fun fact, also according to the Internet Movie Database, her maternal aunt is Rue McClanahan.
Get the fuck out of here.
I shall not. That is what it said.
Wow. That's a fun bit of trivia for sure.
Apparently, Rue McClanahan hung out on set one day. I would love to see some sort of like footage in the documentary about like just Blanche wandering the set.
I was going to say, if you could get all the Golden Girls onto that set, that would be an interesting little featurette right there, you know.
I would be there for it.
Despite the fact that you'd think a movie on this scale would make so many very, very clumsy choices in terms of storytelling, there was one thing that absolutely, well, many things, but one thing in particular that stood out in terms of filmmaking. And that was the shot where the mirror breaks. And you've got all of these shards of mirror and the characters reflected in the pieces of the shattered mirror. In a pre-CGI era, it looks like the kind of thing you need CGI to capture. And it's a very impressive and conceptual in terms of cinematic art. In the middle of this gleefully trashy movie, I thought that that was the kind of moment that almost sort of makes you pause the film and digest it a little bit, because it's really unexpected.
It really is. And I like how, while it is a movie that really could be very, very formulaic and very, very, okay, so we're going to hit this beat, then this beat, then this beat. I wasn't necessarily surprised by anything that happened, but it didn't feel like something I'd seen 100 times. And I think it was the fact that they did the past life seance, even though that's a ridiculous thing that did not make much sense. And they had that shot with the mirror. Yeah, like they made interesting choices. So that's our show. If you have seen this, we would love to hear what you think. Please contact us on social media. And don't forget to join us on our regular release day of Tuesday. We will be discussing the original Paranormal Activity and Paranormal Activity Next of Kin.
It should be a lot of fun. So yeah, we really hope that you'll tune in. Once again, I'm Josh Bremont.
I'm Kelly Hager.
And remember, everyone deserves at least one good scare. Take care.